I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. It's Midday at the Movies. Today, on this 75th anniversary of the invasion at Normandy that changed the course of the Second World War, we consider the movies that have shaped our understanding and memory of the global conflict that resulted in the deaths of nearly 3% of the world's population in the 1940s. Maryland Film Festival founding director Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday, the film critic of the Washington Post, suggest some of their favorite war movies, and we'll open the phones to hear your selections of the films that are the most influential and lasting cinematic portrayals of World War II. Plus, does the play that goes wrong make all the right moves at the Hippodrome Theater? J. Wynn Russick has a review. That's all coming up on Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Tom, that music doesn't get any less cheesy on repeated hearing, does it? It is, of course, Hooray for Hollywood in a cheesy version, and that means today it's Midday at the Movies. Anne Hornaday is with us. She's the film critic for the Washington Post and the author of the number one hit bestseller, Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Nice to talk to you as well. I'm a talking picture myself, if I'm talking.
You are, of loveliness.
It's a double entendre, which is very impressive because they used to call movies talking pictures.
This is true.
And I just got that. This book's been out for 3 years, and it just dawned on me. There you go. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, and the book of your new autobiography, Jed Dietz, My Life at the Cool Kids Table. I think that's going to be a good one.
Right.
I'm really looking forward to that. You know, having never sat at the cool kids table myself.
I thought that's where we were right now.
That's it. Nope.
Looks cool to me.
We're here in Studio A, and today, of course, does mark the 75th anniversary of a very solemn occasion, the invasion at D-Day, the massive Allied invasion of Nazi-occupied France that began on this day back in 1944. So early this morning, Eastern Time, Prime Minister Emmanuel Macron of France and President Donald Trump spoke at a ceremony marking the anniversary, which included more than 60 World War II veterans and a large crowd in Normandy, France, near the graves of more than 9,300 Americans who were killed in that epic battle. Over the course of 3 months, 1 million Allied soldiers joined the battle to turn the tide of the Second World War. Nazi Germany surrendered less than a year later. The existential threat to liberal democracies was a preoccupation not only of the political and military leaders of the day, but also of scores of filmmakers then and ever since. So today we're going to talk about the movies about and inspired by World War II, films that were made soon after the conflict and in the decades that followed. So what's your favorite World War II movie? How do you think that movies about the war have helped succeeding generations understand the sacrifices made 75 years ago to defeat fascism in Europe? Our phone lines are open. Our number is 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. So, Anne, there are sort of like categories, it seems to me, of World War II movies or war movies in general. But let's sort of limit our discussion, at least initially, to ones about the Second World War. There are those that are these big sweeping, grand 30,000 feet views, and then others that are much more intimate.
Right.
Is there one style or another that particularly resonates better or worse for you or most people?
Honestly, I feel that when they're done well, they each has just great riches, you know, and rewards for viewing. So I love them all. I mean, it's like I said, it's all in the execution. So you could have something as, you know, sweeping as a Saving. I guess I don't know if we would describe Saving Private Ryan as a sweeping epic because it begins with that incredibly memorable invasion, beach invasion scene. But then it gets very specific. It's about this very specific family and these brothers and this one mission. Or then you have something so claustrophobic like Das Boot, you know, this tale of this submarine. So So no, I kind of love them all. I'm a sucker for these.
Yeah. Are you an aficionado of war movies, Jed?
Well, the World War II for sure. And I agree with Anne. I think they both these very small detailed movies. There was a wonderful movie about the last few days in Hitler's bunker called Downfall. A woman arrives to be interviewed to be a secretary toward the end of this. And that's an unbelievably great movie, very, very tiny in scope. But I think that opening sequence in Private Ryan, nobody shot anything like that in wartime. I mean, and I think it's, it changed movie history, even though it was made way after most of the World War II movies had been made, you know. Mm. So.
Yeah, we have a clip from the beginning sequence, and so many people have seen this movie, you know, that the first sequence is like 24 minutes long where they're in the boats and they're, you know, approaching the beaches. And you see this, as you say, Jed, just something that none of us had ever really encountered in a movie theater before.
Shore. We got no DD tanks on the beach. Dog one is not open.
Who's in command here?
You are, sir.
Sergeant Horvath?
Sir.
You recognize where we are?
Right where we're supposed to be, but no one else is.
Come on, you where they're supposed to be. Shore party.
First wave, ineffective. We do not hold the beach, say again. Do not hold the beach.
We're all mixed up, sir. We got the leftovers from Fox Company, Able Company, and George Company.
Just the way they do the audio, those bullets, feel like they're whipping past your very ear, you know, and the chaos of these encounters.
So I'll tell you an interesting story. One of the actors in the invasion and part of the team in the whole movie is Edward Burns, who had just started his career as a filmmaker. He had done a very tiny little independent film called The Brothers McMillan that had done very well at Sundance and launched him as a filmmaker. And he said being with Spielberg, somebody who, unlike an independent filmmaker, or maybe the most pure independent filmmaker, because he literally can do anything he wants. He has access to any piece of equipment, crane shots, helicopter, anything. Yeah,
the budgets are no question.
No constraints on him. And he said in this sequence, to see him choose to use these handheld cameras, which were really new technology and imperfect technology, and make choices as he was filming this unbelievable sequence. He said, without cranes so much, without fancy equipment, but sort of choosing away from all of that. And he said, I couldn't figure out why he was doing this, given all the options he's got. And I think you've just described why, because he knew there was some sense of intimacy and immediacy that we were going to feel, the audience was going to feel, because of him joggling the camera or, you know, having to cut away from an immediate shot. I mean, obviously he's a great filmmaker, and as Burns had said, he had all the tools available to him, known to man at that point, and he chose to film in this way that to this day lives as a very, very powerful piece of...
But he was also explicitly referencing Robert Capa. I mean, I think it was that choice was really motivated by...
And Robert Capa is...
The great, great war photographer who did all of those
still photographer,
uh-huh. Exactly, from Magnum. And he shot the Spanish Civil War. He shot World War II. And I guess my impression was always that was the visual grammar that he was going for, and that those were the photographs that inspired so much of the visual design of the film. And again, so then that means you've got to get handheld and you've got to get sort of raw and as spontaneous as you possibly can.
Ben Mankiewicz in the New York Times wrote yesterday about how at the time of the release, the summer that Saving Private Ryan came out, and it escapes me for the moment what summer that was, but and I'm sure Aunt Google will call and tell us when Saving Private Ryan was released, but the Associated Press reported that summer that the Department of Veteran Affairs had to set up a national hotline for veterans and their family members who needed help after viewing the film.
Oh,
you
man.
Know, I mean, that's it had that kind of impact. Yeah. And of course, and he goes on to write, this is Mankiewicz, he says, a creative artifact had as much weight as some of the best reporting.
Mm.
And this is the thing that movies can do.
That's right.
Mean, and so the question is, do these movies paint a historically accurate portrayal? I think of Dunkirk, for example, and I guess some of the characters in or none of the main characters in Dunkirk actually existed. They were composites,
probably.
From what
yeah,
I've read. So you know, it's not like we're taking these actual individual people and their individual diaries or whatever. But these composites give you, you know, a very intimate view. I mean, you follow these three or four fellows around and you know, you see how they made it through.
But I think what Ann said is it's all about execution. I mean, 20th Century Fox had made a huge movie called The Longest Day about the D-Day invasion with, at the time, every movie star that they could get their hands on. John Wayne and Richard Burton and Sal Mineo.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Sean Connery was in it. Yep. I mean, Rod Steiger. I mean,
it was one of those,
we could take
like
up the whole show.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
It's a cavalcade movie.
And it was one of those.
And that's specifically about D-Day, right?
Yes. And it's about this invasion. So it's in that same territory. And Anne's right. I mean, I think Spielberg, obviously a student of movie history, knew well The Longest Day. But understood the visual power that had been in still photography, because those were the only people that could be, men and women, Margaret Bourke-White was one too, and Robert Capa, who were amongst the soldiers, who were embedded with soldiers before we even knew the term. And he wanted to bring that to filmmaking. And that's what's so fascinating to me is he, you know, many years later, with every tool available, figured out how to do it, and it was giving up some of the tools, you know, and putting us on that beach. Mm.
Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, is here in Studio A, along with Ann Hornaday, who writes film criticism for The Washington Post. We'd like to hear from you folks about what you think your favorite and most impactful World War II movies are. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet @midday. WIPR. And Google did call. 1998 was the year of Saving Private Ryan. But Das Boot, the one about the German submarine, that's way back in 1981. I mean, these do span a long period. And they started making these movies like almost like during World War II.
Absolutely. I mean, that's true. The myth making, you know, and we're going to be talking about William Wyler, I know, in this conversation. And he bridged that, because he was making films during the war, about the war, and then I think, in my humble view, made the greatest World War II movie ever, Best Years of Our Lives, as a direct result of seeing what he saw on the ground.
Let's go to the phones to Frank in Baltimore. Frank, welcome to Midday with Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday.
Hello. Wonderful, wonderful conversation. A comment and a couple of nominations. Number one, I went to see Saving Private Ryan with my younger brother at the Senator. We went to a matinee, and most people in the audience were older. In fact, I made a joke coming in. I said, you know, good thing about going to a matinee, you can sit wherever you want because you know you can beat them to the seats. And we watched the whole film, and as we were leaving and we got to the lobby, I stopped in my tracks and my eyes started to well up, and I said to my brother, I just realized all these old men are those 20-year-olds we just saw on screen. And the women with them are their wives and their daughters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the first time they've been able to see anything that approximates, you know, what they had gone through. And I was just stunned.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of movies, there are two Burt Lancaster films, one, The Train, and the other, Castle Keep. The latter was more impressionistic, but in both cases, you had Nazis that were involved in stealing Europe's artwork, and Burt Lancaster was a soldier who didn't know anything about art, didn't care anything about art, but he was a good soldier who was, you know, saving this. And both of them, it's just fantastic films, and thank you all for having this discussion.
Yeah, well, thanks for that observation, Frank. I really appreciate it. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed a guy who's a political economist from University of Oxford in London. His name is Will Davies. He wrote a fascinating book called Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason.
Oh, wow.
And he's talking about how the rise of populist movements in the United States and Hungary and Europe, et cetera, other places, has much to do with fear and that the sort of internal nervousness that we harbor individually and how that translates on the geopolitical stage. He makes the observation that the introduction of aerial bombing, which happened in the Second World War, was a real inflection point for the human condition.
Fascinating.
In World War I, 5% of the casualties were civilian.
Right.
In World War II, 50% of the casualties were civilian.
Right.
And by the time you get to the 20th century, later in the 20th century, in the wars in Africa and other places, 80% of the casualties and fatalities are civilian. So this notion that you could be living in London or Berlin or Nagasaki, Japan, and this terror would rain down on you from
indiscriminately,
the sky,
right,
indiscriminately,
random,
when you get
no
a 30 seconds notice, maybe with an air raid siren, just changed the course because it allowed political will of peoples to be swayed one way or the other. You had Churchill, bucking up the English populace because the Nazis were doing their darndest to literally break their will.
Right.
And so it's just this fascinating notion that all of a sudden when civilians became targets, and now, of course, with terrorism and sort of guerrilla warfare, we have civilians being targeted
purposefully
and in small numbers, even. Mm-hmm. So it's not even like they're trying to bomb all of Cologne or London. So fascinating stuff.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Let's go to Andrew in Baltimore. Andrew, welcome to Midday.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. One of the things I find fascinating is movies that deal with the stealing of Enigma machines. Mm. So everything from The Imitation Game to U-571, and looking at that dynamic of the war. But since it is D-Day, I know another one that has always been a favorite of mine, and it's a television series, is The Band of Brothers, documenting the 101st Airborne drop near St. Mary Galilee's, and how well that was done. I think a lot of the credit also is due to Dale Dye, who I think also had dealings with Saving Private Ryan and his work to bring that level of authenticity to those films.
So he was like a consultant and historian who was a consultant on the movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he does a lot of that for a lot of those movies. I've never met him, but he just seems like a really neat guy.
All right, two great suggestions, Andrew. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and continue our conversation about movies having to do with the Second World War. Which ones are your favorites? Which ones are the ones you think have had the most impact, lasting or otherwise? Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Ann Hornaday is a film critic for The Washington Post. Our phone number is 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on our program tomorrow, a conversation about the recent wave of state laws that have severely restricted abortion. And they aim to overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in the United States. We'll be joined by Kim Whaley. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. We'll also talk to Stephen Aden of Americans United for Life. That's a group that opposes legalized abortion, as well as Karen Nelson. She's the CEO of Planned Parenthood of Maryland. So hope you'll join us for that conversation tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, our guests are the Maryland Film Festival's founding director, Jed Dietz, and Washington Post film critic Ann Hornaday. And on this 75th anniversary of D-Day, it's Midday at the Movies, and we're talking about World War II movies and how they've shaped our understanding of that huge global conflagration. We want to hear from you. What are your favorite movies? What are the movies that have had the most lasting impact on your life? 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, that's always strongly encouraged, @TomHallWYPR. So, Ann and Jed, let's go to a clip from a 1946 movie by William Wyler called The Best Years of Our Lives. So, at this clip, the war in Europe is now over, and there are three vets that are hitching a ride back to their hometown in Iowa. They're trying to get back to Boone City, Iowa. So, they're on a B-17 plane, and as they watch the countryside passing below them from the Bombardier's Bay in the nose of this plane, two of them, Dana Andrews and Frederick March, play these roles. Talk about their anxieties about returning home.
Remember what it felt like when you went overseas? As well as I remember my own name, I feel the same way now. Only more so. I know what you mean. Just nervous out of the service, I guess. The thing that scares me most is that everybody's going to try to rehabilitate me. All I want is a good job, a mild future, and a little house big enough for me and my wife. Give me that much and I'm rehabilitated like that. Well, I'd say that's not too much to ask.
Nervous out of the service. Now, of course, we talk about PTSD and these other, you know, lasting, lingering effects. William Wyler, a very important figure in filmmaking in general and in war movies in particular.
Absolutely. And he had made, he was in the war and was commissioned to make a documentary toward the end of the war to kind of boost morale here at home. And he ended up making The Memphis Belle, The Flying Fortress, about the B-17 bomber and following a crew ostensibly on its last mission. I think technically it was its second to the last mission. But he filmed these gentlemen. The B-17 bombers, these were just hugely dangerous missions. They lost nearly 30,000 men on these missions. They just were asked to do so much for so long under just extreme physical and psychological emotional stress. And I feel like all of that, what he lost, one of the cinematographers, Harold Tannenbaum, lost his life. Mm-hmm. He was shot down during the filming. So they not only captured firsthand what was going on, but they experienced it viscerally. And I think he brought all of that to bear on this movie, where there is just such sensitivity to returning veterans, the physical challenges. Harold Russell plays a soldier who's had his hands blown off. He had his hands blown off in real life. Reconnecting with their families, jobs, a society that doesn't want to hear about their sacrifice, wants them to kind of, they resent them because they're back taking their jobs. I mean, so it's so ahead of its time, and it's just so magnificently acted. Frederick March and Dana Andrews, you could hear there, Myrtle Loy, beautifully filmed. But interesting side note, a new documentary has been made using the restored footage of the Memphis Belle documentary. It's called The Cold Blue, and it's airing today.
Today
and tonight on HBO by Eric Nelson. He went to the National Archives. He looked at the footage. He meticulously restored footage from the movie itself and also some outtakes. And then none of the crew members from the original movie are still alive, but he managed to track down the surviving pilot, you know, the 8th Air Force members who flew B-17s, and we hear their voices describing what it was like. It's very much like They Shall Not Grow Old, that magnificent World War I documentary that we all
love.
Peter
Jackson,
earlier this year. I really urge people to watch this. Like the gentleman who called about Saving Private Ryan, it just brings tears to your eyes.
Yeah.
It's just the most moving testament I can recommend.
And it, for me, showed us a part of the war toward the end of the war, so not the D-Day, past the D-Day invasion, that I really knew this bombing had gone on. I knew about Memphis Belle, of course, from the film world. But the scope of this, I mean, just what you were talking about in your previous interview, when this guy talked about going from so-called precision bombing, although precision bombing meant that a third of the bombs landed within 1,000 feet of their intended target on a good day, if the weather was good.
New meaning to the word precise.
Right. But then they went into carpet bombing, again, purposefully, and the footage, the data is incredible. 3 million civilians were killed. 7.5 million civilians lost their homes during this. But the visual of this that Weiler got from these planes as they sweep over Dresden and other Bremen and other German cities, you cannot believe what you're looking at. I mean, I just had no idea of this, you know, and the fact that Angela Merkel, the head of Germany, is now with our president and the head of France, is like a miracle to me that could be followed a mere, you know, 60 years later, 75 years later.
Yeah, my dad, who was a World War II veteran, was not part of the Normandy invasion, but fought in the European theater and was actually captured as he was a prisoner of war for like the last 3 weeks of the war. Mm. He was in the Battle of the Bulge. Which makes, you know, when Mr. Trump says things like, you know, that are just so blatantly stupid and brutish, like, you know, I like people who don't get captured. Right. You know, it just drives you nuts that these you know, brutes are just, you know, feel at liberty to say that sort of stuff.
Who've never fought in anything. Yeah, either,
but,
right.
But even if, you know, even if he had fought, I mean, it's just a horrible, horrible thing to say about Senator McCain and anybody else. But he and a bunch of buddies of his in a platoon before he was actually discharged. He came back to the United States. They sent him to California, and he and a bunch of guys were extras in a movie called Desire Me, and it had something to do with an army base and stuff. And he's in this one scene where he's sitting in the back of a truck driving, you know, across the thing when the stars of the movie, you know, talk. So, you know, so that's my one claim to Hollywood fame. My dad. Desire Me. Let's go to Gail in Pasadena. Gail, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hey, speaking of B-17s and POWs, my father was shot down over Germany. His B-17 was shot down, and he was captured and was a POW and Stalag 17.
Wow.
The actual Stalag 17.
Oh,
and, and God bless him. Obviously, he survived because you're around. Yeah, right.
Yeah, no, Academy Award winner. We never watched it because it was a tacit, you know, we just knew he didn't want to.
Yeah.
But I remember once my parents were going out for the evening and it was on television, and I remember saying, can we watch it? And my father goes, well, sure. I never said you couldn't. But he watched the opening credits, and I turned to him and said, Daddy, did it look like that? And he said, just like it, and walked out of the room. He was there for about a year and a half. You know, they beat the crap out of him. They starved him. He got one postcard out that was heavily redacted, but he made jokes about how it was, a country club and all that. But in one corner, we're Greek Americans. In one corner, he wrote to now, I'm hungry in Greek. Yeah. Mm. So it was, it pretty intense. But he also, this is kind of interesting in itself, one of the screenwriters, they were screenwriters and playwrights, the two guys who wrote Stalag 17 because it was on Broadway as well as a film. One of them was in the bunk next to him.
Whoa.
We know that, but we don't know which one.
Yeah. Oh, so, my. Well, that's
isn't
a great
that crazy?
Story.
That's amazing. So this Cold Blue film that HBO is going to air tonight talks about how hard it was to survive a B-17 going down, because when they started to go down, they went and they'd been hit and started to go down. They went very fast, and the gravitational force, it was just almost impossible to get out of the plane. And there's some unbelievable footage in here from other B-17s about when a fellow B-17 in one of their formation planes would go down. They would wait to see if there were parachutes, because they couldn't really see very well. And of course, they're being shot at and stuff at the time. And it was a very low percentage of people that got through. So it's your dad's a very courageous and lucky guy.
Yeah, well, thank you, Gail. I really appreciate that call. That's terrific. Let's go to Stuart in Baltimore. Stuart, welcome.
Hi, thanks. So I wanted to mention a movie that I saw in the early 1960s was a German movie called The Bridge. And the plot was that it's towards the end of the war, and a group of Hitler youth are mobilized to defend a bridge from the advancing army. And it shows the battle and, of course, their defeat. It was very, thinking back on it, you know, after all these years, I think about the Germans who watched that in their own cinemas in the 1960s and saw, you know, their children who were, you know, these kids who were, you know, full of, you know, blind, irrational patriotism, just, you know, at the end of the war, still remaining fanatic and willing to die.
Yeah, wow, thanks for that observation, Stuart. Appreciate it. We have an email from Walker who says, can you talk about Downfall and the difference, to Stuart's point, the difference between German World War II films and American British films?
Well, I would mention another one called Mephisto, which is, again, small in that group. And this is about an actor, all fiction, I think, but an actor who, as the Nazis take over Germany, gets sort of co-opted. He doesn't agree with them. He doesn't believe in anything they're saying, sees the brutality. But his career is just starting to build. And it's again, one of these intimate pictures of the World War II world coming and mattering to just individuals.
And there's a movie called Never Look Away,
oh, yeah,
which is about Gerhard Richter, who is a painter. And at the time, I guess there was something of a taboo about painting any, and I don't use the term painting in a literal sense, but depicting any suffering of Germans in a positive light.
Well, I mean, I think that has been a taboo. I think for a long time it was. It was just not spoken of. It was deemed inappropriate. And so I think it's fascinating. This is a beautiful film. It was actually nominated for an Oscar for its cinematography, very rightfully so, about the development, the childhood of Gerhard Richter and how the war influenced him as a painter. And it really, it's all about these tensions. I mean, he had relatives who were Nazis. He had relatives who were anti-Nazis. He was this young kid kind of taking it all in, taking in the degenerate art exhibit and all of the messages that had. Later coming under Soviet influence when Germany, you know, came under Soviet, was a Soviet satellite. But I think it's really the deep ambivalence about the German conscience, I guess, or German soul right after the war, about how to process the evil that was done on their behalf, but also their own suffering, you know, that was real and deserves to be legitimized in that way. And I think the movie just gives all of that great expression, and it's just a beautiful film. I don't know if it's still in theaters. Do you, Jed?
I don't think so. It was here for a while at the Charles, and I think did pretty good business, but it's...
Well, check it out. If it's out, I think it might be on DVD pretty soon or streaming, but by all means, check it out.
We have an email from Michael who says, I'd be remiss if I failed to mention my favorite anti-war film, King of Hearts, which ends up asking, who's the crazy one?
That's the Alan Bates movie, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. That's a throw... Wow. Good one.
Good one.
Well played, sir.
Daniel writes us a very nice, brief, succinct email. One word, Patton.
Oh, well, ooh, of course.
So
my
now,
goodness.
A movie like Patton, I mean, what's your take, Jed, as to the sort of historical accuracy of a movie like Patton?
You know, I don't know enough about Patton. I know there's one of the key incidents in it is when he slaps a soldier, and I know there's some dispute about what happened exactly in his life. And the soldier is suffering from what we would now, you know, recognize as PTSD, having come out of battle, and this infuriates Patton, and he slaps the soldier, and he loses his commission as a result. I mean, it's a horrible PR. I mean, he shouldn't have done it, and he gets reprimanded for it horribly. George C. Scott, playing Patton in the movie, says, I wish I'd kissed the soldier. But it was a hugely successful movie, and it is very much in the big epic sweep because that's this character. And you see a warrior who... You know, you see both sides of a very great warrior.
In the 1970s, when I would take my guitar down to the Boston Common once a month and protest the Vietnam War, we often alluded to these World War II movies as glorifying war, that the American public had been sort of brainwashed by so many of these movies because it made it seem not quite as bad on the battlefield and very good off of the battlefield, the camaraderie, and you always get the pretty girl and all that stuff. But the wars, the battle scenes themselves were not that particularly horrible, and we were seeing on the evening news from Vietnam real battle scenes that were horrid, but beyond anybody's imagination. So there's that whole notion of, you know, I guess you would call it propaganda.
It was propaganda. And I think, again, to circle back to the Cold Blue, at the beginning of this documentary, these veterans, many of them were 18, 19 years of age when they were put in this situation. And almost to a man, they say, now I know why they send young people to war, because, you know, now that I'm older, I would never have done it.
You would never have done it.
And it's just a very sobering. And it also really brought home to me, I think, a lot of the children and grandchildren of these veterans wonder why their dads and grandfathers don't talk about the experience. And this movie, The Cold Blue, really brought home why. You know, why people may not want to revisit that time.
And also for this time, you know, 1% of our population are fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq places, you know, and then it was everybody.
Exactly.
I mean, it was everybody.
Yeah.
And when you went, I mean, John Kerry made this point on television this morning from the Normandy ceremony, that when you either enlisted or were conscripted, you didn't come home. You didn't go for a year and then come home and take a break and then go back. You just went until it was over.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when the job was done, everybody got to come home.
Well, in the Cold Blue, it's so interesting. The goal when they start is 25 missions. And then it moves to 30, and then it moves to 35.
They keep moving the goalposts, right.
Let's see if we can sneak in a couple more calls before we run out of time. Jason in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
Doing great. What's on your mind?
There's a movie called Live, Die, Repeat that came out a few years ago with Tom Cruise in it. They changed the name to Edge of Tomorrow, I think. But that was not really a remake of a Normandy battle, but they brought these aliens that they're fighting or whatever. It takes place in France, in Normandy. They just totally kind of revamped the story.
What's it called?
Good catch. Edge of Tomorrow. It's a wonderful movie.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Really,
and so that's based on the Normandy invasion. Okay, thanks for that call, Jason. Appreciate it. Herman in Waverly. Herman, welcome to Midday.
Hi, everybody. Well, by the way, I'm a Korean War vet.
Thank you for your service, sir.
I didn't have to shoot my gun, nor was I shot at.
Good.
I want to mention All Quiet on the Western Front.
Mm.
The scene where the young hero comes back home on leave and is invited by his school to describe his war experiences, which he does in a very, very negative way.
Mm.
And he is booed out of the room because all the teachers and so forth there were supporters of the war.
Yeah, thank you
after
for that.
After that kind of pageantry of the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
This
fascinating
celebration.
Yeah. Thank you for the thing. So we only have a few seconds left, but I do want to talk about some of the Holocaust movies. Of course, Schindler's List, in my own life, one of the most moving cinematic experiences I've ever had, and historical experiences, emotional experiences, educational experiences. I mean, and there have been many other Holocaust movies, but I think this one does sort of stand by itself.
It's still one of the highest grossing films ever in Germany. Too. It's very interesting, and it was even thought of. This had been in the works for 10 years. Spielberg was not, he had bought the rights to the book, was not set to direct it. Didn't think he was old enough when he first bought the rights to it, tried to get other people he admired to direct it. Sidney Sheinberg, his great mentor and head of Universal, didn't want to make it because he thought it had no commercial potential and all this kind of stuff. And it resonated with people around the world, Tom, like
that. Yeah, well, it's a masterpiece. And As are you two. Masterpieces in your own right. So really good to see you. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival and Hornaday. Her latest book is called Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. And we'll have a link to Ann's essays and film criticism in the Washington Post on our website. Coming up after a quick break, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins us with her latest review. We're going to talk about The Play That Goes Wrong. It's what Luke Spicknell calls Every Day at Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.